This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, and on this week's episode, we'll be discussing the state of mental health in this country and whether doctors are all too happy to prescribe medication as the miracle solution to mental illnesses. We'll also be asking what on earth is the deal with Cambridge Analytica and commemorating the death of the world's last male northern white rhino. First up, is medication the answer to our mental health crisis? Studies show that the British are among the most depressed in the developed world. But, Angela Patmore writes in this week's cover piece, doctors rely on pills too much and overlook their terrible side effects. I've written about those side effects in my own piece for the magazine this week, and Angela joins us now with Professor Simon Wesley, Professor of Psychiatry at King's College London. So Angela, your argument in your piece this week seems to be that you don't think antidepressants really work, and yet we're being told to take more of them.
Well, the Cipriani meta-analysis suggests that lots more people should be given antidepressants and that they work better than placebos. But according to scientists who've analysed the results, the actual difference is clinically negligible.
And Simon Wesley, you are a psychiatrist. Do you agree with this assessment?
Not entirely, no. I mean, you would expect me to say that. Cipriani, it's a study of huge numbers of trials, but it's only for 8 weeks. But within that 8 weeks, I think the evidence, most people who've read it will find it pretty compelling that there is an effect of the antidepressants. It's a moderate effect. The best way of kind of explaining to people is to have one person respond to antidepressants. You have to treat between 4 and 7 with it, which is about the same for most drugs. But well, let's be clear, though, that study was of short-term effects, not long-term effects. But I think in the short term, antidepressants are a moderately effective treatment for depression. They're by no means the only treatment. They're not the treatment I probably would first use, but also I would use it. Well, I do use it. And if I was ill myself, I would want a combination of antidepressants and talking therapies.
So talking therapy would be your first line treatment?
Certainly for mild to moderate, yeah. But if I was getting to more severe illnesses, I would want both. But given there's a waiting list for one and not the other, I would start with antidepressants whilst I'm waiting to be referred for a psychological treatment. That's what I would do for myself and my family.
Angela, isn't this the problem, that actually antidepressants might be working better were they being prescribed alongside a talking therapy rather than a patient having to wait so long to get...
I'm sorry, Isabel. I think we're missing a very important point here. If you take the patient information leaflet out of the packet, say of amitriptyline, I was prescribed these for back pain. It says in there, if you are depressed and or have anxiety disorders, you can sometimes have thoughts of harming or killing yourself. These may be increased when first starting antidepressants. That's very important, isn't it?
Well, I think there's two responses to that. The first thing to remember is that pharma, which I don't represent, tends to put down every single possible eventuality so they can't be sued later. The second thing is, certainly some people, when they start taking antidepressants, and particularly in younger people, do get some side, well, a lot of people get side effects. And some of them, such as increased anxiety, restlessness, etc., can be associated also with thoughts of self-harm. The biggest problem we have, though, is the fact that antidepressants are given for conditions that are associated with self-harm themselves. And it's very difficult to separate those out. Very difficult. And the final point to make is this. Everyone agrees that the rate of antidepressant prescribing has been going steadily up year on year for many, many years. That's undisputed. We can dispute whether we agree that that's a good thing or not, but it's utterly undisputed that it has been going up in all Western countries. Even a small association with suicide or homicide would show itself up in the statistics. But of course, during this time, fortunately, apart from when the chancellors mess up the economy, suicide rates have been going down and homicide rates have been going down in Western countries as well. So I suspect there's many things between these on the way. And overall, I would say that the benefits of antidepressants outweigh the risks that are reasonably well known.
May I ask your comments, Professor Wesley, on the campaign for evidence-based psychiatry, drawing attention to the dangers of antidepressants, both homicide and suicide, which have occurred for patients who've been taking these drugs without any forewarning. And the campaign for evidence-based psychiatry are, like yourself, all medically qualified.
Okay, Simon, so what do you make of that?
Well, I know all the people you mentioned personally. I've known them for many, many years, and they have very strong views. But unfortunately, those views are not really accepted by the majority of the profession or regulators, issues like NICE. And I've kind of talked about why these things might go together. First of all, people unfortunately do use antidepressants to kill themselves. Amitriptyline, one of the reasons it's not prescribed very much these days, is it's not a good drug to take an overdose at all. And you'll have an association that way. And even the evidence on akathisia, the feeling of restlessness, what I mentioned earlier, there's no doubt at all that that's increased in people who've taken particularly the newer drugs, some of the SSRIs, and particularly in children, where antidepressants are still used, but not very much, but they are. But it's a very big jump to say that that then is the cause of homicide. In the studies that Peter Gottschalk, who I've known for a long, long time, quotes, he's making a massive extrapolation between the increase in these side effects. And then he says that in those who have, if we have the records, committed suicide or homicide, we find an increase in symptoms such as agitation, anxiety, etc. That's true, but it's a huge jump to link those two together and not being able to show that in the big randomized trial. So I think we have to say, I go back to the point I made, which is that even a relatively small direct risk associated with antidepressants would be visible in suicide rates and homicide rates. We always have this problem in which antidepressants are not randomly taken in the population, and very rare events such as suicide and homicide are also not randomly distributed.
But Simon, surely the side effects of antidepressants can be quite debilitating or at least uncomfortable. In my piece for the magazine, I've written about some of the side effects that I wasn't warned about until I discovered them popping up uninvited in my life when I was taking citalopram, mirtazapine and then sertraline. Is it the case that there needs to be much more research into improving antidepressants so that people might be able to take them for the rest of their lives if necessary, or so that they have greater efficacy? My understanding is that the efficacy hasn't actually improved since the first modern antidepressant in the 50s.
Yeah. Well, first of all, there are people who do take antidepressants for very long periods of time and they find it keeps them healthy. So some of them will be listening to this podcast. And the first thing I would say is that's fine. That's absolutely fine. Second, yes, of course, we need better drugs. Of course, I'm a psychiatrist. I treat people. Of course, we want better drugs. Third, all drugs will have side effects. You show me a drug that has no side effects, you're looking at something that doesn't work. I think if you weren't warned about the common side effects, I think that's a shame, and you should have been, and I think most reasonable doctors do that. And finally, what I think will happen is we are steadily, slowly going to get better at predicting those who will A, respond, which we're not very good at predicting now, but there's some new evidence coming out that seems helpful. And second, we might be able to predict those who will get certain side effects, and this will be from the increased knowledge that we have of genetics. And we've seen it in other drugs not used in psychiatry, some in psychiatry. I would think over the next 20 to 25 years, we'll have much better what we call precision medicine, and we'll be able to say, you shouldn't take this drug, you'll do better on that drug. But at the moment, we're not at that point.
Angela, why do you think that the UK has such a high rate of prescriptions for antidepressants? Is it that we are more mentally unhealthy than other countries, or is it that the NHS is structured more towards drugs rather than therapy?
I think that's a very good question, Isabel. There is a sort of elephant in the living room here, and that is, why do people opt for brain chemicals rather than alternatives, which have got our ancestors through far more perilous hardship than we face? Our ancestors would find it mind-boggling that we're even having this conversation. They didn't have antidepressants. What about the people that got through the Blitz with cups of tea and stiff upper? Are we going to laugh at them? Were they just naive, uninformed?
But Angela, surely actually this sounds like a very nostalgic
view of our ancestors and our ancestors' mental health. I mean, if you go back a considerable way, our ancestors' natural way of dealing things was to die around the age of 35. And if you look at the Second World War, for instance, shell shock meant that young men couldn't speak for years as a result of what they'd seen in conflict, people in the Blitz. And during the First World War, young men were shot for desertion because they were running away from the front line.
Could I, Angela, just come back here and agree with you? I've written quite a lot on the Blitz and how people reacted to it, and we write a lot about the over-diagnosis of trauma and trauma-related syndromes in modern society, and we've done a huge amount of work showing that the first things that people do are always the right things, that we underestimate the resilience of normal people, and we do have a tendency to lead to technological solutions, and I quite agree, and all the work we've done on trauma supports that. What I'm saying is that doesn't always work, though. When the first thing, talking to your friends, your colleagues, whatever, which is how most people deal with adversity most of the time, doesn't work, then it's time to maybe look for other things as well. And I think we're lucky that we do have other things that we can turn to. But your first point is absolutely right. And I'm quite well known for making those arguments that people like me, my profession, politicians, planners, all of these things, always underestimate the resilience of normal people facing adversity. But fortunately for those, for example, who don't have social networks, who've had pre-existing mental disorders, whatever, who would go on to develop actual illnesses such as post-traumatic stress, depression, etc., I'm also glad I live in a time where we now have better talking treatments and some drug treatments that are helpful as well. But your first point is absolutely right. I agree with you.
Can I ask you what you think of diagnostic inflation, please?
I'm completely opposed to it. You're talking about things like the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual.
I am.
This comes, the Americans have, is it 660 different categories of psychiatric disorder? Gets bigger every year. Although actually this year it got smaller, but that's because they printed it on thinner paper. And, you know, and they have caffeine drinking disorder, answering back to your parents, obsessive love of guns syndrome. Actually, I made that one up. Actually, they don't have that one. They should have that one. They don't have that one. No, but people in my trade, we're completely against that professionalization of normal emotions. We have enough trouble trying to get good services for people with, everybody would agree, have severe psychiatric disorders. It would not be in our interest to medicalize the whole generation of children, adults, etc. The people you'll find who are totally against that are people like me.
Thank you, Simon, and thank you, Angela.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
This week, serious questions have been raised over the power of Facebook as a series of exposés uncover the way in which political consultancy Cambridge Analytica used mass data to Trump's benefit in 2016. In this week's magazine, Jamie Bartlett writes that Cambridge Analytica is just the tip of the iceberg. He joins us today together with James Ball, who has debunked the myths surrounding this tech in The New Statesman this week. So James, for those who are perhaps a little bit confused about what on earth this row about Cambridge Analytica is actually about, could you provide a brief and understandable explanation?
So at the core of this row is how Cambridge Analytica got hold of Facebook data on about 50 million people. And what they did in 2015-2014 was they acquired a personality quiz made by a Cambridge academic that sort of tied your Facebook profile to personality traits. And they then heavily promoted this to US users and even offered them about $1 a time to take it. And so they would log in with their Facebook account and take this quiz and get a payment. But it didn't just sort of take their Facebook details when they did that, and that would kind of be okay, that would be business as usual. It also took Facebook information of all of their friends, and the average Facebook user has 300 friends. And so this meant they ended up with a database of about 50 million, mainly US users, the vast majority of whom had had no say in their data being collected. And then what's alleged is they used the insights they learned from this to help the digital strategy of the Trump campaign, which is actually something Cambridge Analytica deny.
And Jamie, how useful is this data, actually? It all sounds very clever, but does it really help campaigns predict and target accurately? Politics is pretty unpredictable at the moment, even though we claim to know a lot more about the people voting.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's worth separating what Cambridge Analytica did or is alleged to have done with this data and whether it was properly accessed or whether they deleted the data as they claim. And that's really a question of whether they followed the rules and whether or not any of the techniques that they employed actually made a difference in the election. They're, in a sense, two slightly different questions. There's no doubt, however, that most modern political campaigns rely heavily on all sorts of publicly, commercially available data, including Facebook. It is very, very useful. Quite how useful, still not entirely sure, but you can kind of judge it by the amount of money that every political party is spending on all of this. Certainly when it comes to targeting users, Facebook is very handy indeed. And Brad Parscale, who was running Trump's digital campaign, sort of credits Facebook's targeting system with having won them the election, because it allowed them to get sort of very finely grained messages to people that previously were beyond their reach.
Is this data, James, stuff that people are volunteering, or is it the sort of things that they don't realise they're volunteering? So, for instance, their location, their conversations privately that they're having via Facebook Messenger, for instance.
So I think the thing we need to remember is Facebook itself has access to all of this information on all of us. You know, it knows actually which bits of our feed we read. It knows whose posts we're most likely to like or comment on, as well as all of the sort of more visible stuff that we put on our profile. And some bits of that they use to customize our feed. Most of the things that they target the advertising on, though, is the more obvious stuff. Which pages do you like? What do you go to? And that sort of thing. And so we have to remember, Facebook have much more ability to help people target adverts than this database would ever give Cambridge Analytica. But most of what was taken, this wasn't a hack. This wasn't them getting into private messages. This was them seeing information people had put on their profiles, things like sort of name, gender, rough location, as in, you know, the place you put as your hometown kind of thing, and then information on likes. And so really it was helping them find ways to help target stuff. It wasn't the deep information that Facebook has access to.
Jamie, is this now the future of political campaigning? There may be a row about it at the moment, but as you say in your piece, all political campaigns use Facebook in one way or another, and the detail that we know about people is just going to grow. So surely, actually, what needs to change is people's awareness of what they're handing over to who.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely where it's heading. The truth about the way that Cambridge Analytica worked is that Facebook data, what exactly they did with it is still not entirely clear, but I think it was probably, at the very most, a relatively small fraction of the total data that they had. I mean, they claim to have over 5,000 data points on 200 million Americans, and that's all sorts of publicly available or commercially available data. Our spending patterns, credit records, store cards, all sorts of different things that lots and lots of companies just like them are doing. And lots of political parties, including the Democrats in the US, are using very similar techniques. So the focus on Cambridge Analytica maybe risks obscuring the much bigger issue, which is the entire nature of political campaigning is turning into this kind of war over software and algorithms and nudges. And as we share more and more data about ourselves, or more and more data is created about us, more and more of that is going to be gobbled up by political analysts and used to try to message us. So at some point, yes, we are going to probably need tougher regulations on all of this, because the direction of travel, I'm afraid, is that it's just going to get more and more intense.
James, did Cambridge Analytica influence people's Brexit vote?
There's really very little evidence to say they did, and it's actually not at all clear that they even worked on it. Leave EU, various senior people at the time talked about working with Cambridge Analytica, so it looks a bit weird now when they say that they didn't. But it would have been entirely legal and okay for them to have hired Cambridge Analytica, and they could have declared it, so why do it in secret? There's actually really no evidence that Cambridge Analytica actually influenced the US vote at all. I think the thing that's quite easy to forget is they ran the digital campaign strategy of Ted Cruz. And actually, a lot of the details of this leak emerged then. And because Ted Cruz's digital campaign was rubbish and he was losing to Trump, it was hard to see it as too scary. When we then sort of hear, oh, well, you know, they ran Donald Trump's campaign, were they involved in Brexit? These are kind of jokers. They're not really the high-end professionals of the industry. A lot of people do what Cambridge Analytica do better than them. But because they had such aggressive marketing and made themselves out to have so much data and be so talented and so sinister, when they now try and turn around and go, you know what, guys, we were kind of talking rubbish, we were bluffing, we're pretty harmless.
It's too late to
There's
have the
no
rat in the
benefit
moment.
Of the doubt, yeah.
And Jamie, even if Cambridge Analytica weren't able to manipulate people into voting a certain way, you do worry about the impact for democracy of micro-targeting that you talk about in your piece.
Yeah, I do. I part company a little bit with James on this, because I think that he's definitely right that a lot of people are just incapable of comprehending that Donald Trump could have possibly won, and Cambridge Analytica's sinister tools might be an answer for the unimaginable victory that he secured. I think there is some evidence that Cambridge Analytica, together with RNC analysts and Facebook and Google employees that were working on the digital campaign, they were seconded in to the digital campaign in Project Alamo in San Antonio, Texas. I think their campaign was smart enough to be able to reach just enough people in these key districts to have swung the election. So, you know, Michigan, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin were all won by less than one percentage point. And so it is possible to say that together they did have a difference. But you're right, I think the bigger picture here is what this type of electioneering does to our democracy. I mean, to me, it's going to increasingly push more and more power to people with good data analysts, lots of money who can afford this kind of thing. But also maybe more broadly, the personalisation and micro-targeting of information all the time, I think, chips away at the idea of a public sphere. If everybody receives personalised messages about the one thing that they care about, and they receive a message from a politician about exactly that in some kind of private advertisement that they receive, what is the public sphere anymore? I mean, everybody's just receiving different and sometimes maybe even contradictory messages about politics. And how do you even hold politicians to account when that's the case? So I think this opens up some much more fundamental questions about how we run politics in future.
James?
So I actually share almost every fear about micro-targeting that Jamie does. Although I would add, we micro-target in real life. Anyone who's ever been canvassing knows that you quickly sort of take a look at someone, how nice is their house, what's it look like, what's the first sentence they say about the party, and you sort of think, am I going to go in on our nursery thing, am I going to go in on pensions, am I going to promise no tax rises, am I just going to attack, you know, that scruffy, horrible opposition leader, or, you know, whatever you do, canvassers know, you micro-target like that way. You send different leaflets to different neighbourhoods, which is obviously cruder, but we've always kind of done it. But I do think there's real dangers to democracy in a lot of these areas. But I think, as Jamie very rightly pointed out, this isn't about Cambridge Analytica, who I suspect this time next year, maybe this time next month, won't exist. This is about, firstly, making sure that all messages that politicians and parties send to anyone should somewhere be visible to everyone. And then you can't do gutter campaigning in corners. But it's also about, we're really going to have to think about the relationship we have with our data and with all of these companies that give us things we really value for free. And that's a trade-off that we've made without thinking about it. And perhaps the sort of real good that can come of Cambridge Analytica is that legislators, regulators, and actually we as society think about our relationships here.
Thank you, Jamie and James. And lastly, on Monday, Sudan, the world's last male northern white rhino, passed away. Now only two females remain. Aidan Hartley, our correspondent in Kenya, was the only journalist who saw Sudan before he passed, and therefore he saw, in effect, the extinction of a species. He joins me now. So, Aidan, you witnessed an extinction recently. Tell us a little bit about that.
I live in a very beautiful area of northern Kenya, close to Mount Kenya, which is very wildlife rich. And just down the road, there was a rhino called Sudan, and he came from a subspecies called the northern white rhino. And he was the last male in the world alive. And I asked to go to see him on his deathbed. He was 45 years old, and he was the last chance, really, for a natural breeding program with the last two females, his daughter and granddaughter, that lived in the same place. And so I wanted to witness the event of an effective extinction. I mean, barring a Jurassic Park-style miracle involving lots of science, this is a subspecies of rhino that is gone. So that's why I wanted to be there. And the keepers let me sit with him.
And so there's no way of breeding the white rhino now that he's gone. There's no sort of sperm bank or anything like that that can be used.
When he died, they harvested his testicles and they've got sperm on ice. But the real challenge is getting eggs out of the two females, Najin, which is his daughter, and Fatu, his granddaughter. And to date, they haven't been able to get eggs out of them. They're much more complicated than human beings. And so IVF will, for the rhinos, be a much more complicated process, which they haven't succeeded at yet. And this is important because the northern white rhino, which may have gone, if they can find a method of saving this species by harvesting eggs and then bringing them together with the sperm in a very scientific procedure, then this will be relevant to a couple of other rhino species, the Javan and Sumatran rhinos, both of which are dwindling into the dozens. But that science is not proven yet. So in the last days before he died, I wanted to experience what it would be like, this sort of irreversible event of an extinction. I just wanted to mention some of the things that I felt, because I felt strangely privileged. I mean, when you think about extinction, it's quite a big thing. Imagine witnessing the death of the last dodo or the quagga. And I sat there touching him and stroking his back. He had his horn shaved off to deter poachers from killing him. And he was also very old and he'd been in captivity since he was a baby in the 1970s. So he was very friendly. But I was intimately sad, as if I was with an elderly relative fading away and holding my hand. And I thought about, you know, what this meant in terms of we've destroyed such an iconic megafauna species. I mean, he was probably the second or largest species of megafauna on land that has lived on Earth for countless millennia. I also felt rather sad for myself and for our kind, because we will become extinct too. I mean, extinction is just a matter of time. But I also felt finally outraged, because I think that the science, at the end of the day, was just a question of money. Had we devoted enough money to the rescue of this particular species, then I think that we could have achieved it much earlier. I mean, many years ago, possibly decades ago. But the interest just wasn't there. So this big boy has gone. These two last females, if they don't yield up eggs, will be gone too.
Why should we care about that? Extinctions, as you say in your piece, do happen all the time quite naturally. Why is this any different?
Rhinos are an iconic species. They're very big. They're very famous. Every child in a storybook knows about rhinos. They're ingrained in our culture. They're a big mascot animal that represents our success or failure in the conservation of many other species. And I say in my piece that, you know, lots of animals go extinct all the time, but lots of them are things like tree frogs that probably haven't even been named for science. This was an achievable project. The scientists have a lot of the science that would achieve a breeding program, and it would have cost only about £7 million possibly to go through with the whole project. They couldn't get any of the money that they needed from the big conservation organisations that tried to take a pragmatic approach and say that, look, we want to spend the money on saving other rhino species like the black rhino in Africa and the southern white rhino in Africa. And we just don't have the cash for this. And so last year, an advertising company promoted a campaign to suggest that Sudan was joining Tinder and he was the most eligible bachelor in the world. Swipe right to help him. And this directed people to a fundraising website that crashed because it attracted so much attention. But out of that campaign, they only raised £60,000, which does seem pathetic. And in the piece, I talk about how we do value animals. British dog owners spend £10.6 billion a year on dogs, but we could only raise £60,000 for Sudan and his two females. And that seems pathetic. So why is it important? One of the reasons is because science could have achieved a successful result. And I think that that would have been a redemption for all of us.
How do you think things could change? People have recently become much more aware of the level of plastic contamination in the oceans, for instance, and are trying to make changes both personally and in terms of government policy to stop that from getting worse. How can we have a big awareness moment for the mass extinction that's taking place, not just in terms of species like the white rhino, but in terms of the invertebrates, mammals, plants in this country as well?
Often it seems that it's too late for a lot of species, butterflies in the UK or rhinos in Africa. I mean, obviously, people are becoming more engaged because they're scared and people act out of self-interest. People watch documentaries about rhinos on the BBC, but that doesn't mean to say that they're going to become totally engaged by contributing money. But I mean, obviously, there has to be a lot more thought. It's not just money. I think saving landscapes is what's important. In a sense, the irony is that Sudan's story is sad, but he is an individual and his species may have to go. But the fact is that what we should be trying to do is save the great landscapes that these creatures live in, whether it's a moorland in Britain or a savannah in Kenya. And that requires good ideas. I think that we're in short supply of really clever people coming forward with new instruments, perhaps financial instruments or green bonds, in which common, ordinary people can invest in nature and rescue large landscapes. At the moment, it's almost as if we're coming at this as animal lovers and we'll never be able to save every species by contributing cash to individual programs, although I'm quite keen for people to donate to this particular program to see if we can bring back the last northern white rhinos from the brink of extinction. But in general, I mean, we have to be able to invest in large landscapes and make them successful. And we can make them successful. In my research, I discovered that Yosemite Park in the USA makes £500 million for the people who live around the park, and that ensures its survival. The Lake District makes £2.7 billion a year for local residents, and that ensures the survival of a landscape that's familiar to us. In Africa, where poverty is a huge issue, such landscapes are disappearing very, very fast. And what we have to do is be able to invest, come up with good ideas, rescue the big landscape, and make it viable financially for the people who live around them, so that they don't kill animals to sell them to Chinese apothecaries for medicine.
Thank you, Aidan. And that's all for this week. If you enjoyed this podcast, do pick up a copy of the magazine. It's got great pieces by James Forsyth, Rod Little and Rachel Johnson. You can get a special subscription offer for podcast listeners, 12 issues of The Spectator for just £12. Go to spectator.co.uk/pod offer. You might also want to come along to our event on Russia on the 18th of April, where Andrew Neil will be asking, what does Russia want? Subscribe to the magazine now and you'll receive a free ticket to this event at spectator.co.uk/Moscow. Thanks again for listening and do join us next week.